Want to take a trip through history's major events or explore interesting geographical features and even some interesting scientific developments? Well, join us on My Sunday Morning Take every Sunday morning from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. where we look into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else to help you understand what is happening in the world. You're now listening to My Sunday Morning Take, the show where we dive into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else in between to help you make sense of how it works around you from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. every Sunday.
Dejemos la fiesta, tengo que estar a tu lado y seguir flotando. Quiero que me digas lo que quieras. Píntame ese paraíso que me espera. Poquito a poquito yo tengo paciencia. Si me dejas, yo quiero estar cerca. Thank you.
And good morning, good morning, good morning, guys. Wherever you find yourself, well, welcome to this morning session of my Sunday Morning Take. And as we just, you know, sort of like exited there from the sounds of the fowls, yes, the fowls. Not foul like in football, you know, when you foul someone for a free kick or penalty. No, it's actually, yeah, it is the fowls. It's, you know, the baby horse. The foul, that one. Don't ask me why a band calls themselves the Fowls. I don't know. I like them. They make some pretty decent music, you know. That song that you heard right there, Crest of the Wave, obviously it has a little bit of a, you know, a little bit of a kick to it. Before that, you heard the sounds of, Aaron, well, yeah. Aaron featuring Kanko Musa with the particular song Dime, and before that it was the old song, very old song by the Fleetwood Mac band with the song Over My Head. Welcome you obviously once again to another particular, well, 2 hour session where you'll be in my company from 5 until 7. This morning's discussion is technically a follow-on from our discussion of last week, the one where we looked at India's independence movement. Now, remember, the particular discussion in that context is actually something that helped influence African independence movements. Not entirely. Let me also just be, you know, slightly bold in terms of knowing where to put the full stop by saying not entirely, but it did actually start something. It did kick off a wave in the African context. Now, why do I say this? Well, because India's independence movement began immediately right after the Second World War. The African independences then started cascading from the 1960s this way. So we were in a wave, but we did see it from somewhere. We did hear it or hear of it from somewhere. Now, after all these particular events that obviously culminated up until 1990, so forth, and, you know, even with South Sudan splitting away from Sudan, there has been a school of thought that has existed since 1947. I'm using 1947 as India's particular, you know, as India is the benchmark this way, because India does influence a lot of it. Even though in an African context, you do find a lot of this particular school of thought present as well in the African context. We for this morning, we're going to be looking at the school of thought, dear listeners, of post-colonialism. This particular school of thought positions an interesting particular dimension, that there is one interesting dimension that positions itself from here. We're not going to entirely exhaust this one dimension, but I am going to touch on it right now. So when we look at this particular school of thought, this school of thought tries to determine who writes history from a specific point, from independence, from, what's that other word? Self-determination. From the state of achieving sovereignty, of freedom. Who writes history? Now, when we obviously see these particular scenarios, it's obviously always best to try and understand under what context are we writing the history. I had a fascinating particular, which was fascinating for me, the experiences last year, whereby, you know, a bunch of us journalists had the opportunity of engaging with traditional leaders last year, you know, exploring and thus also, you know, hearing the storytelling from Namibia's particular cultural history, potential. Those particular dimensions obviously outlined what we can see here, as well as also expect if we mainstream these particular cultural products. And it was fascinating to cite because the Ondongo King that we met at the end of the engagement, he shared with us specifically that, look, there is a modernization coming. I'm just summarizing, but he said there is a modernization coming. And it's obviously how communities, specifically traditional authorities, brace or embrace. You can do either, you know, you can either brace by, you know, trying to stave it off, fight it off, or you can embrace it and see, you know, how does it fit into, the ways of traditions, cultures, and the likes. Now, when you look at scenarios like that, you hear different histories, different impacts, different discussions, different backgrounds, different influences. You see perspectives. You see through different lenses. You get to understand micro stories that formed part of a larger story. You get to understand influences, developments and scenarios that you never heard of. So, a discussion like that regarding post-colonialism, I just showed you, just in that small example, the extent to which the discussion on history can take various dimensions, the extent to which. So when you look at the field of study of post-colonialism, on this particular one, I actually advise you guys, go read up on it. In a Namibian context, what I've seen, you know, besides the known academics, but like the everyday conversations, not many people have a conversation about this. Not many people actually exhaust this particular dimension, because post-colonialism is all about who writes history. It's no longer the dimension of what we saw since 1950 or 1945 this way in terms of the victors of 1945, the Second World War, were the ones writing history. It was not that dimension. It was the dimension of one of those victors who then technically were forced to relinquish a position that it enjoyed before 1940 or up and until 1945. So who am I talking about? I'm talking about two countries. The United Kingdom today, but back then they were known as Great Britain, and France. They enjoyed a particular story. They enjoyed a particular, how should I rather say, lofty position. I'll use that phrase, lofty position. They enjoyed a lofty position. In terms of that, they could represent what was, you know, close to 75% of the world. They could represent the voice of 75% of the world, these two countries together. Together. So if they were talking, they were talking on behalf of 75% of the world. That could have been potentially 80% of Africa in many scenarios. More than 50% definitely of Southeast Asia. And then primarily there were also, you know, treaties and all manner of protective agreements that were negotiated with countries who wish to stay, who wish to maintain their independence, but still stay within a realm of charting their own particular history. So, in the discussion that we're looking at for today, I'll start off with sort of like, one particular strand of study within the post-colonialism dimension. The strand of study actually points to the question I highlight to you, who writes history? from a specific point. Now, one basic particular question that many post-colonial historians, theorists, and other writers have asked is, how does the non-European world write its own history? Put the question mark there. How does the non-European world write its own history? Some Indian historians have associated this with the subaltern studies, for example, although it was deeply influenced by Marxism, which also sought to rescue the collective agency of Indian peasants from the category of the pre-political to which they had been assigned by Marxism. You see, and that's even also the thing with a lot of the particular political theories and labels that we see today as well. Africans have tried, yes, I'll use the broad label Africans. Africans have tried socialism, but we ended up with complete dictatorships, authoritarian regimes, and sometimes even complete chaotic scenarios. For example, Somalia. For example, South Sudan. And if you, no, not South Sudan. South Sudan is now technically way more peaceful than South Sudan itself. Sudan. And now the nonsense that is happening in Mali, where you don't know where the battle lines are, you don't know to what extent the insurgents are basically undermining the military government of Mali. And then they've also cascaded in a way into Niger and into Burkina Faso. Let's put a full stop there as well. Because the discussion there also asks the question of how do we form governments that regulate and that govern us in this post-colonial dimensions? Through what particular means? Where do these instruments, these ideas come from? What were instruments and ideas before colonialism? Not that I'm pushing for anything in that direction, because technically that would be close to sedition. It would be. If you look at a dimension of understanding where things were before a specific phase and how you exit from a specific phase, which is the two scenarios I just explained, you know, what were the forms of government before colonialism, and how did you exit from colonialism into what kind of form of government or governance? These particular directions also then get to ask the questions of what societies do you have left after colonialism? Now, as India is mentioned here, firstly, yes, my literature resource primarily is British, so it does start from a very large Indian perspective, starting point off primarily. Is we've also got to identify within this bracket of how countries who are not European had to identify their own identities as well. Now, you would have heard me in many cases, for example, on the home run, highlight that Africa and Europe's particular destinies are technically intertwined. It's not that we are just also stuck in most of the similar time zones, but that we actually have a lot of particular trade in common. We've now actively seen the sort of like the rapid investment and involvement by the EU in Africa's particular industrial goals and needs. And we've also now particularly seen the, closer ties primarily between very stable African governments and countries with the European Union in order to achieve common particular developmental goals. Namibia being one of those particular key examples back in 2024, specifically with the, what was that thing? Forum of the Future and Pact of the Future agreement that we attended and that we signed. And who was our European, was a Global South, Global North representation? Germany. Our former colonial master. Or one of our former colonial masters. So, we get to see this particular example taking place. But here's the thing. At that stage, we could present our own history from a certain point. So far, I think much of many Namibians have been telling their own, have been, or many of Namibia's particular, you know, I'll say up and coming scholars and historians, we have been trying to tell our stories. And historians also include technically us, the media as well. We have been telling Namibia's stories. But we've been telling it to each other as well. That has been the other particular scenario, the sometimes the downside, and sometimes it is in English. It is in English. Now coming, now bringing you, taking you back to the point specifically where we left off in the literature, such an approach, that's now the Marxism approach that India had to first, you know, deal with, such an approach puts into question the very idea of theories of social and historical development in which entire peoples or cultures are located somewhere on a scale between primitive or archaic and civilized. That issue is, however, complex as well. Could peasants be genuine political actors if they did not use the language and practice of rights or sovereignty in the way that European political thought, which was differentiated as it is, conceived of it, was the collective action of Indian peasants, or Australian or Aborigines, or any other indigenous peoples, pre-political or backward in inverted commas, because it was oriented around religious or kinship relations, for example, as opposed to class or universal human interests? And how should those alternative sociabilities be described and made sense of anyway? In those two sentences that I cited there, springs out currently what Namibia wishes to achieve since independence. We wish to achieve diversification, industrial diversification, and modernization. Now, what is modernization? I will continuously answer this like I am a teacher speaking to a classroom full of learners, not students at a university, learners on high school. Diversification means, firstly, skills development across the border in the country, which then potentially would lead to the development of Namibia's nascent and very vacant secondary and tertiary industries. So this is processing and manufacturing together in order to develop and achieve the jobs that Namibia wants to achieve, the jobs, but it also leads to the market development, the economic development, the goods and the products that we can produce in order to fully participate, for example, in the AFCFTA. Another dimension associated to that primarily would be modernization completely in the known examples. Not the Chinese example I've seen. The known examples. From the United States to South America to Europe to even Australia and New Zealand. The known examples of modernization dictate moving swaths or great numbers of people away from agrarian culture, meaning communal land. Communal farmers. Even the existence of traditional authorities. Full part of modernization is within the ambit of what modernization causes. It puts a great threat on communal communities, traditional authorities who are based in communal scenarios, pushing them towards urban zones, because that's where the factories will be contained. No one will build a factory there out in the bush for no reason, because there's no local authority providing services for a factory out there. It's only either a mine or a farm. The factory is always closer to where you find electricity and water. Now, the moment that happens, many people get pushed towards the cities, the towns, these growing towns and cities, because now there are jobs, because you need money in the economy. And they would need places to stay. Now, if that particular scenario happens, dear listeners, you got to ask the question once again. Okay? So modernization, once again, is a European context. Even to great extent, unfortunately, China also experienced modernization to great extent, which is also European context. India also experiences modernization as we speak, which is also a European context. Japan is literally at the forefront of what modernization has led to. Dying towns. Closing down schools. No, really, guys, they've got literally abandoned towns. Italy is at the forefront of that as well. Dying towns. Closing down of government facilities because there's not enough people to use it. So why are you spending money on these things? Whereas countries like Namibia have the opposite. We have a great demand to bring things to a lot of Namibians. So as we currently see these particular developments panning out, post-colonialism has been associated with skepticism about the historicism. Yeah, I know there's a lot of isms in there. Historicism of Marxist and also of liberal historiography. Now, when I say liberal historiography, this also speaks towards the ideas that would be supplanted or that would be planted within storytelling, for example, in a post-colonial setup, because the assumption firstly would be that a newly formed country would be completely liberal, which in many cases is slightly further from the truth, because with Namibia's independence at 1990, we technically were very considerate. We were very conservative. And in many scenarios, people forget that conservatism comes from religion. Another European context, subject matter. People forget that conservatism, conservative mindsets, comes from religion. That particular one sentence that I just cited to you there from my literature resource is the opposite of what we saw since 1990. Namibia is still greatly conservative. I mean, just to use an example, my younger brother, after becoming married and him now being a family man and all, homeboy decided to completely swing, conservative. Because there has to be now conservative values that he is to now espouse, and to adopt, since now being a husband and a father. You see this all across the board in the country. Conservatism also does not translate too right-wing, because it is a mudslinging word that I've realized. Yes, it's a word to taint conservative communities in the world by neoliberals. Let me also be honest. I am a liberal myself. I am a liberal. But to an extent. You see, I'm not a liberal to the extent where I go and call government we must have a small government. It is impossibility in Namibia to even make that claim, because we need to have an efficient government, but a small government is impossible in this particular first phases of these first, like, first 30 years. I mean, even the Americans didn't have a small government when they started off, and even today the Americans don't have a small government. They have an agency for almost many particular needs around every particular corner. They've got interventions for every particular scenario in the event that economic hardships occur in their country. And all of that is based on allocating resources and funding in order to meet that need. Because the question that I always ask is, if you've got a government, if you've got a country, is it geared or positioned towards your society? Or is it geared and positioned towards industries? And believe you me, you will reach discontent in your country quicker if it's geared towards industries. So, we obviously see this particular scenario popping up. These scenarios of understanding, how do we achieve modernization? We obviously see that the templates and particular subcategories of the schools of thought under post-colonialism is continuously influenced, unfortunately, by Europe. You don't hear in many scenarios Africans using the phrase Marxism, except for a couple of guys. And I even question their particular idea around Marxism. I even question it. No, I do. I really do. Because here's the thing. The unfortunate thing with old Marx is, he lived in the 1800s at the start of the Industrial Revolutions. He lived at a time specifically when he was trying to achieve agency for British, you know, for the British working classes. And at that stage, the British Empire still existed. And that was pre-World War I. So, in a context, what are we actually talking about? If we obviously look at the discussions around understanding how you have to tell history and tell the story from now on, a school or a sub particular sort of like an analytical thinking started emerging regarding the skepticism, like I cited, the skepticism about the historicism of Marxist and liberal historiography. For example, that it was about the manner in which the practitioners of these particular historiography, which, you know, in many cases position or posit many universals, how they understand history itself or understood history itself, and how you tell these particular stories. For some, the skepticism has also meant abandoning any particular essentialist representation of Namibia. Not Namibia, sorry. I don't know where the Namibia came in, because I had another thought in my mind. And the representation of identity. Because they believe any identity is always ultimately heterogeneous, and it must be theorized as such. And that obviously has also become some of the particular scenarios in terms of how we tell history. I'll be honest with you guys. I don't like propaganda history because it doesn't tell me, it doesn't position me as someone who enjoys being neutral to a story. What happened? Yes, I'll call it the coffee maker machine because I still call that museum the coffee maker machine. It does look like a giant percolator. I am sorry, but it is a fact. I've seen percolators and I see a giant percolator here in the center of Windhoek. And I've been there 3 times in my life. And I don't like the propaganda. I don't like the propaganda. The reason why I'll say I don't like the propaganda is because it's not a question of, you know, loyalties and the likes. It's a question of how we position the storytelling. How we tell every Namibian, doesn't matter where you were before independence and after independence, how to be part of understanding this particular path that was walked, this experience that was endured, these particular hardships that were encountered. Because believe you me, dear listeners, I've seen the opposite reaction to that kind of particular propagandist historiography. I'll call it propagandist historiography. I've seen it. I've also particularly seen in, like, what's that thing's name? Public engagements and discussions. Where two different communities literally want to argue at a platform. Yes, it is about them. It involves both of them. And this is a purely academic discussion. And the people want to argue right there and then about the facts. And you can see the influences and the discussions are based upon nuances that I did not know about beforehand. Now, obviously, as a key observer, specifically of historical developments that have been taking place in Namibia, once again, the question that is transmitted is a question of how do we see the storytelling taking place? Now, I'll give you a very beautiful opposite of this coffee maker machine propaganda standing here in Windhoek. There's a tomb of the, what do they call those things? But it's there in Enana. No. It's run by the National Heritage Council. There's a lovely lady that any one of you guys can interact with. And she is knowledgeable. I forgot her name. She's knowledgeable about her work. A Namibian. And the monument itself is a little bit dilapidated. Not dilapidated. You know, it needs a little bit more cleaning and, you know, and sprucing up just a little bit. But it is a very beautiful monument of, I'll call it the unknown soldier, but the particular planned soldiers that died. The story, the way that I'll call it the curator for now. The way that curator explained it to us last year. Is technically how we need to be telling a story. Doesn't matter what kind of historical story it is. About Namibia's history. About the various groups in Namibia. But it should be a discussion to cite. Listen, this is what happened. And this is what happened. The reason why we've got these particular tombs, because no one could identify XYZ amount of people, unfortunately, because of the conflict. There, as the South Africans called it, the border war, and as we called it, obviously, the particular liberation struggle that obviously took place. Very lovely storytelling. Very lovely storytelling. Coming to Windhoek, and once again, I will always compare this to the coffee maker machine. Is that the coffee maker machine? Well, firstly, we know what some of the particular limitations are. I mean, it's a bit, yeah, it's a little bit claustrophobic because you've first got to climb the stairs before you get to the elevator, and then from the elevator, you know, you have to get to a certain floor, and from that certain floor, then you can start accessing certain particular facilities. But for now, we at least have to recognize that we've got multiple historical outlets taking place. There is one other particular key development that I've had to look up on in terms of looking at how do we tell Namibia's post-colonial history, not just the post-apartheid history, the post-colonial history. And the saddening one was the discussion during COVID that I once had with a gentleman known as Mr. Laidlaw Peringanda. He's the guy in Swakop who is busy, sort of like he has been for the past how many years now, trying to preserve the actual grave sites of genocide victims at Swakopmund. And it's in and around the neighborhood's name? Kramersdorf. It's in and around there, close to Kramersdorf of Swakopmund. He himself cited how municipal approved developments aimed to destroy such particular historical discussion. It's a literal graveyard that proves victims. And it's these particular kinds of installations that we need to preserve. Because you have to preserve them. Of a specific part of Namibia's history. Now, naivety, and I call it naivety, I would actually call it what it is, blatant naivety regarding cultural heritage. Because culture is not just about a specific group in Namibia, culture is a dimension of Namibia. It's not just one group, it is about Namibia. It's a story about Namibia. It's a particular past of Namibia because it is in Namibia. It's in a town in Namibia. The ease at which historical erasure takes place in Namibia is one of the most alarming things that I've ever observed and witnessed in my life. The ease at which it takes place. Now, these particular developments obviously speak towards, well, it could potentially be about understanding history and its particular importance and the lessons to be learned from it. Or it could be just blatant naivety, like I said a little bit earlier. For example, like the time back in 2020 or 2021, when I interviewed Mr. Peringanda, for a short particular discussion about, and this was related to the joint declaration at that stage that was signed in 2021, if you guys remember, and then, you know, the furor and the anger that spouted out from that, particular engagement, which is part of Namibia's history. So the question once again comes about, because in all of this you can see primarily, how do we write our own history? Now, I'll also be honest with you guys. I've now collected so many books, specifically non-fiction books. Non-fiction books speak about reality, research about real events. A couple of them were written by Namibians, written by people outside of Namibia. Who are not Namibian. even about prehistoric civilizations. Not Namibian. I probably have one. One. And a South African. Yeah. Okay, the other... No, he didn't write a book. I didn't buy a book from him. Yeah. No, and yeah, and another... Yeah, two South Africans. Sorry. And these two South Africans speak from a South African perspective into a Southern African perspective, which includes Namibia. No, four. Yeah. The two Namibians are technically Hendrik Witbooi's own particular papers that were put into a book, which speaks about a particular point in Namibian history. And the second one is about an author. She's an author here, and she looked at the particular impacts, specifically 100 years on after the genocide in Namibia, interviewing communities on both sides. But that's it. That's it. And trying to find a heterogeneous identity. And that is another particular thing with regarding nation building. Specifically nation building with multiple identities within it. And that is currently what Namibia is battling with. We don't have a heterogeneous identity. We don't. We are all Namibian, yes, but we don't have a heterogeneous identity. Now, at the time, this particular dimension of identity was part of the influence of the French philosopher Michel Foucault, who was particularly significant from the 1960s. He explained, for example, in Said's groundbreaking book of Orientalism in 1978, Foucault's subtle conception of the constitutive relation between power and knowledge provided a critical angle from which to investigate the way representations of non-European culture and thought were shaped by a web of institutional and political forces connected to the justification and the practice of Western imperialism. But before we continue, guys, we'll quickly take a short ad break. A short musical break, and we actually come back right after this. We'll be right back.
format. I thought I knew them all by name, but they started looking much the same, and it's no surprise that I don't want to listen. I know I won. There's nothing but rainbows. I believe in the shadows behind me. Thought I might be dropping out, but now I'm gonna work it out. I'm gonna work with me. I'm running like an Appaloosa, then I'm rolling like a rusty ship on a stormy sea. You know what people are saying, strange things. Talk to the head, cause I know your face. The face is gone. I don't wanna listen too much. I'm not gonna give up on all the days I know I won. There's nothing but blue sky. There's nothing but blue sky. Nothing's gonna stop me now. I'm skimming like a skipping stone on a silver lake. I'll take it when the chips are down, but to play the perfect happy clown, you gotta make a mistake. And people are saying strange things, and I don't wanna listen too much, yeah. Nothing but blue sky. Blue sky. How can I tell you? I know this won't be the last song. I don't wanna listen too much. Not gonna give up on all the days that I know I won.
Now
Now, as we come back there from the sounds of Jamiroquai, that with Hot Tequila Brown and with Blue Skies itself, and before that it was once again The Fowls with Wake Me Up. You're here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM, and you're listening to my Sunday morning take, guys, as you're in my company from 5 a.m. to 7. Where we left off primarily with the discussions on, the post-colonialism dimension and its particular discourse that it generates or generated. It follows into the next particular sort of like realm. This realm is the notion of the unmasking the Enlightenment became a powerful theme in post-colonial writing. So, unmasking is sort of like revealing. Playing a little bit of a dictionary role. But the unmasking sometimes is also trying to bring out new dimensions, new schools of thought, new subject matter, new topics, new theories, new themes, new discoveries. And in some cases, it was about how do you position these schools of thought, these ideas, these discoveries, these theories, and so on and so forth. Now, the unmasking tends to generate two kinds of claims. First, certain modes of enlightenment thought are considered inherently Eurocentric, and thus deeply problematic when applied in non-European contexts or presented as offering genuinely neutral principles of political association or justice. But for the second, and perhaps more interesting also, despite the legacy of empire, the humanism and the universalism of much Enlightenment thought is still understood as indispensable for addressing the challenges faced by those on the sharp end of contemporary global inequality. I am in those two definitions, in those two particular ponds of polar opposites, yes, ponds of polar opposites, I am in the second one. I believe you need to know what was in order to surpass and to achieve your own destiny. I believe that, you know, unfortunately, if you find yourself in a position where you look at, you look back to, how did we get here? You know, you analyze, how did we get, you do a little bit of post-mortem analysis. How did we get here? What decisions did we take? What roles did we play? And then you get to the current position where you currently are, you know, as you go through that particular train of analytical thought, and then you go like, okay, there was no way for me to avoid how to get here. You know, if there was a decision, a choice that could have been made, and you find no, 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 no at each particular interval, then you realize, okay, we're here now. We are currently in this boat. This boat's name is Independent Namibia. And how do we then proceed from here? So we've got the museums, and I still have to make a note to go and see the museum, specifically the one of City of Windhoek, to understand, because there is so much untold storytelling in this country that is just being kept hidden. I don't know if it's intentionally being hidden. But there's so much storytelling in this country, guys. Namibia has a very rich historical just deposit of knowledge that we can bring out and we can enlighten Namibians about. So, since I'm in the second school, it's up to you where you are. Are you in the first or in the second? Do you believe, for example, that much of the enlightenment that we see is Eurocentric? I also see it, don't worry. But I don't see the deeply problematic scenario because I know what our shortcomings are as Namibians. I mean, we have to read. We have to read. And Namibia is not a reading culture. Namibia is not developing its knowledge by reading. And then we've gone and done this very absurd thing of promoting the STEM fields first. Now we are trying to get scientists going, but it had to take a scientist, an IT scientist, to tell us Namibians, yes, and I will still recall this report. I think I still have my copy of the report. That we're not doing any research in the social or human sciences of Namibia. We are not. We are not doing our own. We are not. Yes, it's research on things like telling an accurate line or accurate, or having accurate accounts of events, even in the various traditional authorities of the country. Yes. You must be trained, which is Eurocentric skill sets. You have to be able to convert it into a language, meaning writing it down, putting it in a storage, a storable format, which is Eurocentric skills and technologies. And then you've got to ultimately make it available to the public, which is something that a Eurocentric dimension does. And unfortunately, when we go and look at many particular traditional authorities in Namibia, they're very insular. They don't easily talk out. And in a Eurocentric society, it's all about being very transparent and being about, you know, inclusive, which is some of the other particular liberal dimensions. So yes, there's a whole bunch of things, a whole bunch of cascading, nuanced levels that we've got to look at in a post-colonial Namibia. Now, since I said I am part of the second dimension of this particular coin of the Enlightenment discussion, Namibia is technically in both camps today, as it is. We're technically in both camps. The first camp, recognizing that a lot of the Enlightenment is Eurocentric, and there's a lot of Namibians that find an issue with it. I remember to the first days from the oil discovery to the announcements of the green hydrogen program, the skepticism that took place regarding the involvement of foreign countries in terms of helping Namibia achieve, you know, particular sort of like the initial breakthroughs in each of these developments. Yes, it is unfortunately Eurocentric, and it is unfortunately something Namibia has accepted. Number two, we are obviously looking, as Namibia, we're looking into the humanism. We're looking into the universality or universalism of this Enlightenment in order to achieve the various particular developmental goals that we've set ourselves. We've done the goal setting as a country. We realize that the only way to equalize or to basically negate the negatives that are the core concerns that the goals wish to achieve and address, we've got to use the Eurocentric Enlightenment to negate them, to improve, to achieve our goals, to basically find the best platform for every Namibian in the country, and thus see the best of Namibia being portrayed. It is a stormy ship. It is a ship that is currently in a perpetual storm out in the high seas. The scale and the size of the ship has 3 million Namibians within it. The ship is being steered and administered by a handful of Namibians. And this particular ship, it has an idea of its destination. The path to its destination is completely unclear. Completely. It's a hidden path through the storm. We know there's a destination. I think we're probably worse than much of the early European explorers, who were just sailing and trying to make sense of a lot of the coordinates. For example, like with Magellan. Not that I hope Namibia ends up like Magellan and his expedition around southern South America through the Straits of Magellan into the Pacific Ocean, where he literally sailed into that dead spot of the Pacific Ocean, which then led to a mutiny. I don't want to see that. That's the reality of Magellan's expeditions. And Magellan did die. I don't want to see that. I would like to know that the destination is clear, that the destination is in good faith, and that the destination ultimately does promise what the particular pilots of Namibia's Destiny promised. So far, we've just had first mates and captains being custodians in terms of making sure that peace and peaceful society and things persist and exist. But we haven't had real pilots. Pilots who took a knock and said, you know what, we're going to do this. You know what, we're going to achieve this. And we're going to use this to achieve that. Currently, that's unfortunately what our current president is trying to achieve. She's trying to be a pilot, plus being a skilled, navigator. So we have to see, but you don't see much of the navigating. You know, you just see a lot of the, you don't see much of the piloting, you see a lot of the navigating. That's what I should say. We quickly take a short musical break, dear listeners. We come back right after this, and then we get into the last quarter of this morning's session here on My Sunday Morning Take, where we get into the rest of our discussion for this morning.
Self-embrace. give way. Start your free trial today. Come on in the water's lovely look. You could meet someone you like. You're in the meat of your strike. It is that easy. Lunar surface on a Saturday night. Dressed up in silver and white. With colored old gray whistle test lights. Take it easy for a little while. Come and stay with us. It's such an easy flight. You new places keep on popping up since the Exodus. It's all getting gentrified. I put a taqueria on the roof. It was well reviewed. 4 stars out of 5. And that's unheard of. Mr. Bridge and Tunnel, I'm a Starlight Express, the head of special effects in my mind's eye. Okie cokie with the opposite sex, the things you try to forget, doesn't time fly? I'm in no position to give advice, I don't wanna be nice, and you know that. Take it easy for a little while, come and stay with us. It's such an easy flight. Two new places keep on popping up around Clavius. It's all getting gentrified. The information action ratio is the place to go. And you will not recognize the old headquarters. Overnight the never happened. And the days that don't exist. The information action ratio. Only time that we stop laughing is to breathe or steal a kiss. I can get you on the list for all the clubs. I can lift you up another semitone. Take it easy for a little while. Come and stay with us. It's such an easy flight. QQ places keep on popping up. Since the Exodus, it's all getting gentrified. The information action ratio. It's the place to go. Take it easy for a little while. Come and stay with us. Now it's such an easy flight. You know places keep on popping up. Places keep on popping up. Around Clavius, it's all getting gentrified. I put a taqueria on the moon.
Coming back there from the sounds of the Arctic Monkeys with the song there of 4 stars out of 5. We find ourselves about 25 minutes out from the top of 7 a.m. Obviously, as you know, you're in my company up until 7 a.m. primarily. But there's a lot more to try and crunch in specifically regarding this discussion of post-colonialism. Even though we, in our context, we've got 36 years behind us in terms of our history, nowhere are we close in terms of saying we are now comfortable as a country at a certain position. Even though I've heard that some foreigners think that we slightly are comfortable, but we know what our pains are. I mean, it's fair to say we know what our pains are. Working from those particular pains, and obviously factoring in some of the particular developments, obviously, that would, you know, work into these things. I would say, and it's safe to say, that we as Namibia, we are becoming a little bit more aware of our post-colonial, I'll call it troubleshooting and, you know, and panel beating and, you know, and plumbing that we've got to deal with. Why do I say this? Well, we can see this manifesting in foundational sectors, for example, like affordable housing. If you guys remember, I showed up here on the Home Run One stage, and I told Helmut, I discovered by just reading some of the particular council meetings of the City of Vintu Council that when it has to deal with the approval of property amendments in the city itself, there's a little bit of a document, a piece of legislation which forms part of the bylaws of City of Vintu. And I discovered that they use, you know, the imperial system in terms of, you know, measurements. In they mention it in that piece of document. They use pounds per year. No. Is it pounds per square inch or something like that? Yeah, pounds per square inch, the dimensions and measurements. And I sat there frowning the whole time while looking at the document going like, but why is this document relevant in, you know, post-independent Namibia? We're supposed to have updated this document with the metric system so that, you know, if there's a description about, you know, weights and measures and the discussions, we have an adequate measurement to work from, a benchmark to implement from, a direction to achieve. Nope. It was present in 2026. We saw these particular measures. We saw this particular example. One particular thing that also strikingly haunts Namibia a lot is that there's a lot of knowledge outside of Namibia contained in South Africa and contained in Germany. I'll say it again. This is something that haunts Namibia as well. There's a lot of knowledge about Namibia outside of South Africa, outside of Namibia in South Africa, and outside of Namibia in Germany. I say this primarily because I've seen firsthand how inaccuracies were displayed in that ancestral land report. And these inaccuracies do not coincide with historians who are academics, who have written about Namibia, who have written about systems, societies before Namibia was created. Now, we also have to understand that unfortunately, a lot of this, these particular sets of information are written from a research-based perspective. So the researcher is going to stay neutral. The researcher is going to hammer in the facts. And you don't deviate from the facts. And you don't work from the facts. For example, also citing the particular book that David and I, we spoke about the other day, that one about the AFCFTA, constitutionalism, as well as also sustainable economic development. These three dimensions, how do countries like Namibia achieve the balance between these three particular, not schools of thought rather, but rather sort of like key development strategies? Well, here's the thing. A constitution aims to protect and aims to empower. The AFCFTA aims to provide a continental integration. Sustainable economic development rather aims to empower and to improve. But you can't do all three. No. The one we know comes first. Constitutionalism always comes first. Because constitutionalism identifies an individual territory's rights. Sustainable economic development follows after that. And then the AFCFTA. That unfortunately is the order. Because you cannot not have a constitution and then try to adopt things of the AFCFTA. You'll just create problems. It doesn't work like that. You cannot work on sustainable economic development without knowing what constitution you have or what your constitution is saying. And in some cases, I have a sneaky suspicion we might have committed a sin in certain scenarios within, you know, according to our constitution regarding working or firstly trying to prioritize the AFCFTA. I think we might have committed a sin here and there along the side, but it tried to be a good intention. It tried. But you can actually see that it probably didn't result in the proper reaction that we were expecting or not. So, yeah. We still have to look at that. Another scenario obviously is also how do we tell our own story going ahead from this particular point? I recently came back, that's now yesterday. I was in Zambia for 2 days. I came back from this particular conference, which was based upon how the media tells certain particular stories, and the realms within which this particular discussion is contained. Now, it was technically a validation workshop, not a conference, based upon a report that has to come out that looks at a Southern African perspective of storytelling, media storytelling, and various other things. And what has become apparent and very obvious to me is how specifically we tell stories through the media. How even in the evolving technological realms, there's a lot of things working against the media. From economies of scale to advertisers just doing their own thing to governments deciding to do their own thing to, you know, everything just working against technically a healthy media environment from taking shape and continuing to survive in a country, in a specific territory. And I sat there for that 2 days there in Zambia, just in Lusaka, thinking to myself, this is Namibia out and out. I see this in Namibia out and out. The concerns have been, dear listeners, that Namibia has not become, and that's the reason why I made the comment a little bit earlier about being a reading culture. We've got to produce to reinforce the habit of reading. But this also means we've got to print and distribute physical materials like books. Number being youth, people younger than me, have to take up reading books and knowledge and basically work from this particular springboard in terms of saying, I gained new insights, new knowledge, let's have conversations wherever we find ourselves. Another thing that came about, because there was a couple of civil society guys there that cited vernaculars, meaning mother tongues, need to be incorporated into the mainstream media landscape in order to promote a message or to share the information. And it was also a dimension of how do you generate knowledge for those particular communication mediums, because a language is a communication medium, just so that you know. So how do you generate knowledge for them? The words, the contexts, the meanings, the descriptions, and all those particular scenarios, how do you generate it for them? Now, when you have to look at this under the post-colonial lens, under the discussion of post-colonialism, we have to ask the question of, okay, so what would this information do? First and foremost, I believe this information will help firstly shape the creative and the cultural sectors of Namibia. I'll say it straightforward. It will help shape that. Secondly, it'll potentially help achieve some of the particular goals within NDP6. Because you will see realization might take place, but it's 5 years that we are given. I mean, it's a little bit of a quick response. Or let me say, not a quick response, but a little bit of a small response time frame. Because it's not like NDP6 happened at the start of 2025 last year. It literally happened in the middle of 2025. And if you did not know why that particular framework worked, technically NDP5's actual end was in 2023 or 2024. And Harambe Prosperity Plan was supposed to end by the end of last year. But technically it was, you know, substituted by NDP6 because NDP6 had to roll out pretty quickly. You know, to wait until 2025 would have been a little bit ridiculous for us to start from. So NDP6 had to start a little bit earlier than waiting for 2025 to end. And in terms of looking at how we as Namibia interact with the world and the world interacts with us, it then would also be able for us to chart our own particular direction. Now, this is where we get into a dimension of the nitty-gritty in the last 12 minutes for today. The nitty-gritty we've got to look at. We've got the universities. So we have some of the academics. So we are training some of those Namibians. Some of the particular things that we have to look at according to one of the literature resources I've got here under post-colonialism that we've got to take into consideration is we've got to understand the complex chain of political and social and economic and cultural impacts that have left or that are left in the aftermath of colonial control, and that these are essential to understanding post-colonialism. Now, we've done, for example, here on Eagle FM, in conjunction with you, our listeners, we've had that discourse. We identify common grounds. We've even had the particular differences in terms of debates. But you know what was a most important thing about that? We achieved self-realization in every particular scenario like that. It's scenarios like this, specifically also on Eagle FM, actually like an entity like Eagle FM, that we have these particular healthy discourses still taking place. Ask yourself also, in how many other scenarios do you see this taking place? In our context of Eagle FM, we actually record the conversations and we keep it online in a library known as our podcast on our website that you guys can go and visit later on to understand. What did Dwight say there back then, 5 years ago? Because we've got to do this. We've got to capture, we've got to store, we've got to ensure that this still, that this conversation, these particular contributions still persist. That they still exist. That they can still happen. Now, there was a term I used a little bit earlier. If you guys remember, that comes, it was mentioned that it comes through from India, the subaltern peoples or subalterns. Now, post-colonial theory thus establishes intellectual spaces for subaltern peoples to speak for themselves in their own voices and thus produce cultural discourses of philosophy, language, society, economy, and balancing the imbalanced us and them binary power relationship between the colonist and the colonial subjects. Now, a subaltern in post-colonial studies and in critical theory are colonial populations who are socially, politically, and geographically excluded from the hierarchy of power of an imperial colony and from the metropolitan homeland of an empire. Namibia had such peoples. We did. This was obviously also some of the particular train of thought that came up from the other discussion back in last week's My Sunday Morning Take. It was the discussion on the Congo crisis. There was also a presence of subalterns present in the Congo crisis or leading up to the Congo's independence back during the 1950s, before the 1960s, was a period of there were these middle-class Africans who were educated and they were saying, you know what, but they were mostly predominantly urban. And they knew what it was to have jobs and to have money. And when the country became independent, it was a discussion of urban versus rural. But before I continue, let me first get this caller's contribution. Eagle FM, good morning.
Yes, Dwight. Good morning, my son. How are you?
Good on you, Uncle Bona. How are you doing?
No, thank God. Yeah, thank you very much for diving into our history. And it's true that we don't really write ourselves. We're supposed to be writing and at least researching on our history. And then we understand how far we came and what we are doing. So we are actually selling you people there. And who are to also disseminate and educate people on issues of importance like this. So we are really failing. But yeah, it's true. We are doing well, so to say, in terms of political and economic somehow inclusion. But then the issue of poverty is still prevailing. And I don't know how, maybe it's not the one that you know, but we can really do better because if we have got at least stability, peace and stability, So the other time you mentioned about tranquility, it was Helmut from you.
Mm.
So I read this, that word is also being used. I don't know how correctly, if I want to use it, but I always use it in that form, that area. So I think we just need to do work to know our history, and then at least to understand where we are now and where we are going.
Mm.
With all these development plans and all these other things, where issues are being also identified, where we can also take opportunity in terms of business.
Yeah.
And but we don't.
It's not just about business, Angabona. Let's flip it on its head, Angabona. Let's use the phrase a desired positive outcome for the whole of Namibia.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'll ask you. You don't have to answer it now, Angabona. It's just something that you've got to think about, because I asked the question a little bit earlier in the show this morning. We know that NDB6 wants to achieve something, but it's like we are on a ship in a storm. We know where we know there's a destination, because that's what NDB6 says. There's a destination, but we don't know how to find the path that leads to destination. It's like we're stuck in a maze. Mm. And we have to find the right path.
Mm.
So it's a dimension like that, but it's based on that everybody achieves the same positive outcomes from what NDB6 wants to get, or even if it was Harambe Prosperity Plan 2 or any of the earlier national development projects that we had already.
Yeah. Yes, that is the that's our desire, but then how to get there, like you said, seem to be cumbersome.
Mm.
So, but we still have to strive and find a path that can really lead there. But maybe with the certain coordination and put our minds there, and also keep on creating awareness.
Mm.
What is this that we really want? I think we can get there.
Mm.
So, and I've seen now this time around, especially this national development planning, and how they are really gathering those stakeholders to come together and craft up a path in which all you can walk in, and accelerate our efforts and do a lot of things.
Mm.
But we can stop finding.
Mm.
So if we can really coordinate and organize ourselves and just not duplicate issues, I think we can do better. So those plans that you have, national plans that you have mentioned, and I know even when we are doing formulating our policies, our laws and things like that.
Mm.
The National Planning Commission has set up a guide to how to really, how they can really, they help us, they help nation, our country, to formulate documents that are relevant.
Mm.
So now it's maybe a matter of really realigning ourselves, realignment, and do a lot of things in a coordinated manner so that we can really have this desired outcome.
Yeah.
And things are really moving, but maybe we are also not taking up opportunity much so that we can assist, like you guys are doing.
Mm.
So if many people, many, many other institutions can be doing things like that, don't you think that people will not be empowered with information? Dr. Franz was talking about lack of information is a disease.
Oh, Angabona. Do you know what's, and it's that thing that we've been preaching a lot about here, data. look, Angabona, the nice thing is, yeah, it's okay for the ministries to have press releases explaining certain situations, but they do it because there's a lack of data or there's a lack of continuous reporting on developments. For example, Angabona, we need to know what is Namibia's continuous fluctuating labor statistics every year. So that literally Ministry of Labor can say, you know, so many jobs were registered in the economy and so many people got employed to those jobs and so many people got, lost their jobs. And these were the fluctuations per every 3 months. You know, they do like a proper analysis of this thing. Now, why are we even paying attention to the budget announcements from our ministers of finance? Doesn't matter which minister of finance it was, but I cannot listen to that if I don't know how many jobs have been created.
Yeah, I think it's good in the conclusion because of the time now.
Mm.
So since I've been listening, and it's just that sometimes you listen and the sleep is creeping in and you wake up again. And so I think if we can have, because every ministry is faced with, or institution is faced with the issue of poverty.
Mm.
And if those informations are there, if they can able to, I think it's a good thing now that they do that. Even many people, many of those who are unemployed, maybe graduate and all these other things, many of them have not even registered with the Ministry of Labor. So you ask them, have you registered with this institution? People are being registered there. And they see, and it could have started a long time ago, because that ministry should be doing it like this other, this middleman, who are also who have created, I don't know what this labor hire or whatever, I don't know whether it's labor hire. So who are also getting candidates and they deploy them to those who want to employ them, but the same ministry could do that. So instead of you know, remember this organization that people are always complaining about. Is it the one in Chume, Genjera, or something like that? So those companies who are also recruiting people and deploy them to different entities, the Ministry of Labor, I think, can also do that with not only with the public institution, but also private. Or is it not doable?
It is doable, Angabona, but it depends on how it's done. That's all I believe in.
So thank you. Let me leave you and have a blessed Sunday.
You too, Angabona.
So I like this, my Sunday take. What is it? My Sunday take.
Just use that one.
Yes, I use that one. Thank you very much. God bless.
Okay, Angabona.
Good.
Now, that does bring us up to the end, dear listeners, in terms of at the end of that caller's contribution. We will be stepping into a musical break. Technically, we'll be saying our goodbyes because we've already reached the top of the hour at 7 a.m. And we'll see each other again, same time, same place next week. Alternatively, catch me during the course of the week where it will be me, Helmut, and David having our discussions, obviously, on the home run. But on that note, we'll be back right after this.